The following is a class given by His Holiness Jayapataka Swami Maharaj and His Holiness Rameshwar Swami on August 27, 1979 in Bhaktivedanta Manor, London.
Yes, there are, of course, any number of ways that we can come to understand the existence of God. Either by use of our intelligence we can come to understand, or better than that, by direct perception, we can, through the process of Bhakti Yoga, come to see God face to face, and that will certainly convince us. But from the point of view of logic, we can give one or two simple tests. Our favorite test is this point, that just as the existence of a wristwatch implies or proves the existence of a watchmaker, so similarly the existence of this vast and complex material universe proves the existence of a universe maker. This is the point. Just like this wristwatch, a very complex thing. No one can understand, no one will be able to accept that it has come about by chance. Rather, it is to be understood that there is someone who is intelligent, someone who is capable, dexterous, even you'd have to say ingenious, to be able to create such a thing as wristwatch. Would you agree or not agree? Well, the point is that first of all you have to accept that he's there. Now by this simple evidence we can show that if there is wristwatch, there must be intelligent wristwatch maker. So what to speak of how intelligent and how great God must be to have created this universe so complex that this body with 100 trillion cells, so many trillions of living entities are there with so many complex bodies. And besides that, even however complex this material universe is, an even more wonderful thing is that there are living persons within this universe. So, how ingenious God must be, how great God must be, how able and dexterous he must be. This is the first point. That is to say, to accept the existence of God. That is the first point. And the second point is that if God is so great like that, and if we can accept the fact, and you've already proved through logic that you must be able to accept the fact, that we have been created by him, manifested by him, then it should be understood that we must have been manifested by him for some purpose. Just like no one will do anything without a purpose, what to speak of making such a complex thing as this universe and all the living entities within the universe. There must be some purpose. So certainly it must be taken as important goal in our life to try to understand what is this purpose, what is our relationship with this great and super intelligent being, super powerful being that is God. So we first of all have to accept that there is God, and then we have to accept that we have the urgent task to come to understand what is our position in relationship with him. And then if we study the Vedic literatures, especially Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavat Purana, Srimad Bhagavatam, we can come to understand what is the process whereby we can come to directly perceive our relationship with God and finally to come to see God face to face. The system, scientific system, has been given in the Vedic literature how to do this. You simply have to take up the experiment. It's not a difficult thing. Just like you may not believe that hydrogen and oxygen combined in a certain way will equal water. You may not believe it, but you can go into the laboratory and you can prove it by experiment. Anyone can do it. It's not a difficult thing. But if you remain simply skeptic, no, I don't believe hydrogen and oxygen equal water. What kind of foolishness is that? You go in the laboratory and test it. So similarly, you can test whether or not there is God by following the laboratory experiment. That laboratory experiment is called Bhakti Yoga. So many great acharyas in the past have carried out this experiment to a successful end. And they've given their judgment in the form of so many teachers, so many commentaries on the Shastras, in which their personal realization is shining through. So, you can... Very good. You can also come to understand directly by following the experiment the greater charges have done. Mahajana Yenakatha Supanta, the Vedic literature's advises that we have to follow in the footsteps of the previous acharyas, the Mahajanas. If we do as they've done, then we can come to the same realization which they've come to. Just as if we follow any laboratory experiment which has previously been done by scientists, we can come to the same conclusion because it's scientific. So in this way, first of all, to accept the existence of God, that may be a preliminary requirement. Therefore, it is also stated in the Shastra, Ado Shraddha. In the beginning, there has to be at least little faith that there's something worthwhile. If there's no God, then what's the use of trying to understand Him? But if we have this little faith in the beginning, and Ado Shraddha, to Saru Sangha, Bhajana Kriya, then we can begin to associate with sadhus, and in their association we can come to understand what is the Siddhanta, what is the actual meaning of the Veda, what is the proper practice. And in this way, incorporating that practice in our life, we can finally come to understand through our own direct perception. Raja Vidya Raja Guryam Pavitram Yudhamuttamam Pratyakshavagamam Dhamam Sukhankartam Abhinam. This knowledge is a super excellent knowledge, because pratyakshavagamam, it gives direct perception of the self by realization. It is not simply a question of idle faith, blind faith. You can directly perceive God's existence, but you have to practice in the right way, authorized way, according to the instructions of the Shastras and the previous acharyas. Well, I'm sorry about that. He said, if God is supremely good and joyful, then why does He make people die so that everyone becomes sad? Maybe that she had such an experience recently? Huh? No. Grandmother has died or something? No. Uncle has died. That's it.
Of course, Krishna is all merciful. Krishna is all merciful. And therefore, He comes down to this world and He tells everyone that please don't stay here. This is no place for gentlemen. Please don't stay here, because here if you stay, everyone, you all have to die. You come back with me to my eternal abode. There is no birth, no death, no disease, no misery. Why do you want to stay here? Why do you want to stay here in this miserable place? You see, but we are such rascals that all of us, we want to enjoy. We want to enjoy independent of Krishna. We are actually God's servants. his eternal servant. But instead, we are trying to enjoy it like little gods ourselves. Therefore, we are responsible for our actions, and we are forced to suffer due to our foolishness. So God is so kind that he is giving us the chance. You please come back. He comes down simply to attract the fallen soul to go back to the spiritual world where there's no birth, no death. So one has to understand what is the Lord's kindness. Because if we were to stay in this body forever, that would also not be satisfying either to the materialist or to the spiritualist. Because the materialist, he has so many desires which he cannot satisfy in this body. So again, he gets another chance for another body. After death, again, there is rebirth. Then after rebirth, again, there is death. This chain is going on. So for the materialist, it's a new opportunity to give up his old body and get a new body. But we know that at the end of the new body, again, comes another death. So that is not very nice. So therefore, we take Krishna's higher advice, which is to wind up this material business and to go back to him. So, you are a very young girl. Prahlad Maharaj, he said, Kumaram Acharat Pragyo, that one should start to prepare himself or herself for going back to Krishna from the very childhood. So now you should prepare yourself so that you can be finished once and for all with this nonsense birth and death. You become a pure devotee of Krishna and go right back to Krishna at the end of this life. And yeah. See Krishna all your life face to face. This is possible.
Done.
Yes. Yes, God has many names, that is a fact. Still, amongst all God's names, this is of course one of the paradoxes, you could say, although the name of God is absolute, at the same time there are the first class names and second class names. For example, we should say the major names and the minor names. This is described in the sense. Major names and minor names. The names of God in relationship with this, his activities in this material world are considered his minor names. If we say that he's the supporter of the universe, the creator of the universe, or we use some name which describes that, then that's a minor name of God, because that's one of his minor functions. Just like, we can give an example, the Queen in England. You're English? Where are you from? In New York. New England. Oh. Anyway, near the Queen, we have Queen, you know? And she has so many titles. First of all, she's, of course, Her Majesty the Queen. That's her main title. And besides that, she has very personal names like Elizabeth. And besides that, her husband probably calls her dear or something of the sort. So, and on top of that, she has minor names. Like, I think she was the leader of the Scottish regiment of the something or another. She has a whole list. I saw in the almanac. You know what I'm talking about? All of this are names she's got. She's the colonel of the Royal Artillery. She has so many names, so many titles are there. So some of them are minor titles, are minor names, and some of them are major names, like the sovereign, the queen. The major and minor names. And then there are the most intimate names. And the most intimate names can only be spoken by her most intimate associates. If I address the queen as dear, you see, it wouldn't be considered to be very good. I'm not in a position to do that. I would have to address her as Your Majesty. But her dear friends, her close friends and associates, her loved ones, they may call her dear, or her children may call her mother, Your Majesty. So in this way, similarly, God has got unlimited names because he has unlimited positions. Unlimited positions he has. You can call him creator of the universe, maintainer of the universe, destroyer of the universe, sheltered living entities. You may call him all-powerful, almighty, omniscient. So many names you can get, describing his various qualities, describing his various functions, describing the various relationships that we may have with him. But of all of those names, Krishna is the most super excellent. Why is that? Because actually everything else is included within the name Krishna. All of the minor names and all of the major names are all included within the name Krishna, because Krishna means the all-attractive. So everything is included within this. Try to understand this concept. God is almighty. God is almighty. Is that not an attractive thing? Would you call that attractive? That's attractive. God is all beautiful. Attractive or not attractive? Attractive. So in this way you can go down any of God's positions, any of God's qualities, you will find that they all describe something which is attractive. So since Krishna means all attractive, it includes all other aspects which could be described in any other name, and therefore this name of Krishna is the supreme name for God. And it is uttered by his most confidential devotee. Yes, it doesn't make any difference. But still, at one name is the most descriptive. Of course, Krishna and Christ, practically the word is the same. Well, it may be quite that may mean the anointed in Greek, or Greek is a language for Yavanas. Yes, but how do you know that the Christ, the root is the same, sound, you see sound vibration. Sound comes first in the universal scheme of things. At the beginning of creation, the sound is uttered, and the sound has got inherent meaning. The sound has got inherent meaning. So, even you may say that Christ means anointed one, but the root word, the root is the same. Krishna, Christ. No, yes, it says that you can chant either one and the result is the same. Now, even though you say that it means anointed one, it doesn't say anointed one in the self-science of self-realization. I'm sorry. Oh, the cardinal says it means anointed one. Prabhupada says it means anointed one? Acha? That was better than me. Anyway, that means he's been anointed by Krishna, so he's got the same problem. Simultaneously one and different. Yes, that is our philosophy. Achinta Beda Beda Tattva. That the living entity is simultaneously one and different from God. So, first of all, the root is the same. But even if we're not the same, by chanting the name of God, full potency is there. Whether you chant Allah even, which is a different root, whether you chant Jehovah, whether you chant Christ. So they're all good. You can chant any name of God, that is a fact. We don't have any objection. But still, we prefer to chant Krishna because it's the most intimate name, the most fully descriptive name. By chanting the names, holy names of God, the specific Vedic affirmation is Harinama, 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 Eva Kevara, Kulu, Nasdeva, 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 Gatya, Nanta. But in this age, there is no other way. Nasdeva, 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 three times it stays for emphasis. There's no other way, there's no other way, there's no other way than to chant the holy name, Harinama, the holy name of God. As has been mentioned, Nam Namakari Bhavana Adinja Sarva Shakti, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, Nam Nam. I've got hundreds and thousands of names. Krishna has got hundreds and thousands of names. And each one, Sarva Shaktis. Sarva means all, and Shaktis means energies or potencies. He's invested all of his transcendental potencies in his holy name. Just like the same example of the queen. Whatever you call her, will she not know it, that you mean her? Say you call her the colonel of the royal artillery. That's her. So she'll answer, is it not? All right. And if you call her the queen, she'll also answer. If you call her the sovereign, she'll also answer. Because they're all names of hers. So you call her any bona fide name, and she'll answer because she knows who she is. So this is the point. So she'll answer to any name, but still there are more intimate names and less intimate names. This is the only point.
Did everybody understand? Yeah.
Do you understand the point or not?
Yeah,
all right, so now we can have someone else. But someone else should.
Prabhupada said that there is one God.
Yeah.
And I don't understand exactly why, although he has thousands of different ways, it's necessary to adhere with great fervor to one particular name.
We chant scores of names every day, different names. But I think all of us, what is your favorite name, Prabhu? What can we do? It's a personal thing with us. Does anyone else have any other questions? Yes, that's right. But that is a personal thing. We like the name Krishna.
English devotees are good listeners, but the German are good questioners. So far they're winning hands down in German.
Good question.
Oh, yeah. At least 20 people at all times had their hands up.
Yeah, they're good questions, that's a fact. All right, Prabhu, you've
been informed in so much.
You've been challenged. Is it possible that the English will be defeated by the Germans in everything? All right. This boy. He's one of our finest.
How do we, or why do we? What? Why? For when we leave this body, at that time, if the Yamadutas are going to escort us away, then it's very painful for the attached person to leave his body. So at that time, the Yamadutas put one asleep and rip one out of the body. They didn't put one asleep at that, for that moment, it would be very too painful. Then one's taken, and when he again takes after it comes time for him to take birth again. Then when he's in the womb, then for the period of his growth in the womb as an embryo, He is unconscious. So that unconscious state is like a long sleep. And then one wakes up, even within the womb, one wakes up about the human being for 7 months. Usually the baby becomes conscious. And even in the Bhagavatam describes how one can have recollection of previous birth at that time. But when one is born, of course, you see, at that time one is in a womb, he's not conscious of his body so much. Of course, he's conscious of his body, but at the same time, his mind is very clear because he doesn't have such developed senses. Of course, he can feel that sometimes the biting of the worms in the mother's womb and the intestine, they come over and they bite the tender skin of the baby. And then, of course, he can feel that when the mother takes very spicy food, that will also feel very hot on the baby. And also the bad smells, these things he can get some feeling. But basically, his consciousness is not so much centered in the senses apart from these very obvious things. And he's able to remember even previous birth, if he's very fortunate. What happens is at the time of birth, it is such a painful experience. He is literally forced through very small opening, and that is such an excruciating pain that he's completely unconscious. And then usually waking up when he is born again. Of course, it's very famous to see the doctors slap the baby. He cries and starts to breathe. At that time, then one tries to gain knowledge through the newly acquired senses, which are basically developed. And so, through these senses, you see, then one is having all new experiences. So then he forgets, generally speaking, the previous birth. This is actually a boon by Krishna, because if one remembers all the previous births, that's not all good. You have to remember so much garbage also. So this gives a person a new slate, a new chance, by Krishna's mercy, to again try to satisfy his desires. One time, devotee asked Prabhupada, why we can't remember our previous birth? And then Prabhupada said, what's the advantage? This birth, you've got so many things you should forget. Now you want to remember the previous birth, so much more. We want to remember Krishna. We don't want to remember our previous birth. Because in our previous birth, if we have done so much materialistic activities, what is the use of knowing that? The thing is that we should know what is our original relationship with Krishna. That is what is essential. So if we can accept that we forget our previous birth by Krishna's mercy to allow us a fresh start. Many devotees, I'm sure that if, like Bhaktivinoda Thakur prayed, that if I don't make it back in this life, then at least that I can be born in the family of Vaishnavas in my next life. So that way, you see, one will, right from the great opportunity of the children born in ISKCON, right from their very birth, they have the opportunity of knowing about Krishna. They don't have to go through all the material hard knocks. They can be immediately taught about Krishna, and if they're fortunate, they can become pure devotees very easily if they have that good fortune. So we can accept that forgetting the previous birth, that's also Krishna's mercy.
Any other question?
Yeah.
If a karma yogi, what is your definition of a karma yogi?
A it come up to my well, I didn't come in fact. Somebody who works, he has a family. He looks after them and himself. And as I say, family, he will do, he likes to think he's a devotee of Krishna. And is he a real devotee?
Well, simply by looking after yourself and looking after your family, you're not necessarily a karma yogi. Yoga means union. Union with God.
Oh, we did that all right, yes.
And
not on a full-time basis.
Well, the point is that you can remain with a family, you can remain in your business also, but at the same time, you can be fully engaged in Krishna service. This is the important point to understand. But real karma yoga means, karma means working, real karma yoga means action in Krishna consciousness, working in Krishna consciousness. The point is how to always be fixed in consciousness of Krishna and how to work in such a way that as a result of your work, Krishna is glorified. This is the point. As a result of your work, Krishna should be glorified. For example, say I am working in order to raise my family. Now, simply to raise my family, that is going on in any species of life. The tigers are also raising their family. The monkeys are also raising their family. Simply to raise the family and give food and shelter and so on, that in itself is not praiseworthy. However, to raise the family in Krishna consciousness, that is an act of devotion. To raise my children so that they are from the very beginning of life remembering Krishna. To deal with my wife in such a way that she can come to remember Krishna and in this way go back to home, back to Godhead. This is an act of devotion to Krishna. So if I'm dealing with my household affairs in that way, and if I'm using the fruits of my work, whether I'm doing business or service or whatever my position is, I'm using the fruits of that work in order to glorify Krishna, then I can be considered a pure devotee of Krishna. Even I may not be living in temple and shaven head and so on. There are many examples in history, just like as Srila Charipad was discussing, Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, his picture is here, the fourth one, no, last one on the end, Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He was the father of 11 or 12 children, Srila Charipad, Bhaktivinoda Thakur. I think 11 children or 12 children. Anyway, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, one of the most prominent examples in recent history of great devotees who at the same time maintained their household situation. So it's not so much a question what position you're in the Varnashram, whether you're Grihastha or whether you're Sannyasi. Rather, it's a question of what is your consciousness. And the proof of what your consciousness is, on the manifested plane, is how you're working, how you're acting. Not automatically that you're a pure devotee, because you're working to support your family, and you're wanting to be a devotee, but that you're actually manifesting works of devotion 24 hours a day.
Now this is where, how wrong is one performing whatever he's performing, but without being aware that, oh Krishna, how wrong can he be?
How wrong
even though he's not aware of Krishna, but isn't he Krishna himself working there, looking up in, sorry, within him? Just the little fact that he is not aware, how much difference does that make?
That makes all the difference in the world.
I'd like to think a bit more about that. I think, supposing, don't you think, just because a person isn't aware, how wrong can he be? I would like to think Krishna might well be there too.
Krishna is there. That is a fact. And Krishna's consciousness is always blissful. Satchidananda, that is the nature of Krishna. Anandamoya Vyasati. The nature of God is that he's always blissful. And if you're aware of God, then you're also blissful. And if you're forgetful of God, then you're miserable. So it's a big difference. There's a big difference between being blissful and being miserable. So if you're aware of God, then you're blissful, and if you're not aware of God, then you're miserable. There's a big difference, even though God is always there.
Yeah, I think you mentioned a couple of ideas. But I think even those people, even they are a bit lesser in degree, I think Krishna is still there. And even I think the best thing is to start from their standpoint, whatever if we ever want to raise them. I think we've got to go from their standpoint to raise them.
Yes, so the best thing is try to get everyone to become Krishna's devotee by chanting all the names of God, giving them Krishna prasadam, and trying to explain to them the scientific knowledge about God. And another question? Indranudra?
Can you understand when there's a great disaster in the world, a good demon can be born?
Do you want to try it, Pastor? Of course, you're coming from Punyabhumi. I don't know if you're... We're from Deutsche Land here.
Of course, I stated that whenever there's a earthquake, hurricane, at that time, those who are born, it's a very good time for demons to be born. So that can be accepted that some demon is being born at that time. Of course, so long as you're talking about birth, you see, there's also something which has to be born in everyone's heart. And that is the bhakti loka, the seed of devotion. That is very urgently required to be born by any means. So that is planted, of course, by the pure devotee in the heart. But you probably you've ever made the sugar?
I have made sugar.
From the sugar cane?
From the sugar cane?
Have you seen the sugar cane?
I've seen sugar cane.
The sugar cane. Sugar cane, well, of course we discussed a little bit about beating the sugar cane, but when one crushes that, then one gets juice. Sugar cane juice. Prabhupada, you would like to take sugar cane juice?
Yes. That I know. That I also take.
So does Krishna. Probably with a little lemon and ginger.
Yes. And black pepper also.
So, this analogy has been given, and actually we've seen because of Mayapur we grow sugar cane. So the analogy has been given.
Here you can grow sugar cane.
Can we grow here?
Not very well.
No. If you don't get the right place, it doesn't get sweet. So there you see we grow the sugar cane, and first the seed is planted, and from the seed comes the sugar cane stalk. When that's ripe, then we cut the stalk and we crush it to get out the juice. The Mayapur juice is so thick, that one can only take about one glass and he's completely overwhelmed. Two glasses and he's overflowed. So when we take the juice and we put
there's
it...
There's a lot of sweet nectar running in Mayapur. That's okay.
So we take the juice and we cook it down in a big pan. Mm. And when the heat is applied, then the sugar cane juice comes to a boil. So when it starts to boil, then all kind of little dust, dirt, impurities, they come out. And a type of foam starts to rise. So that foam comes to the top. Then we take a spoon and we take the foam and we throw it. So this has been described by the Acharyas. That when we... First we get the seed of devotion, then that grows and that becomes sugar cane, grows a little more refined, becomes the juice. Then when that real heat, when the real enthusiasm of devotion starts, So many, you see, dirty ideas and desires, then they come as if from nowhere. You see, so just like that, impurities are coming in the sugarcane juice when the heat is applied, one takes and throws. In other words, as soon as the thought comes, other than pure devotional service, one should simply neglect it. You should take it and throw it. So, actually, there's something, you see, when we made sugarcane, then we found that this foam was relished by the dogs. They would come and eat that dirty foam. They loved it very much. So like that, we can understand that all these dirty things, these are material desires simply fit for the dogs. So then, of course, you might be wondering that how we are cooking this sugarcane juice. Where do we get the firewood from?
The sugarcane stalks.
Yeah. The sugarcane stalks themselves, once they are pressed, those provide the fuel. In other words, devotional service is self-sufficient. One doesn't have to rely on jnana or yoga or karma. Simply by bhakti, by devotion, that is enough. So just like that, the sugarcane stalk himself is providing the fuel. You don't have to look elsewhere. So in the same way, devotional service, that provides all the nourishment. One doesn't have to go anywhere else. So then what happens is, finally all the impurities are gone. And the pure, bubbling, hot juice is boiling. So what happens, that becomes more and more and more condensed. Finally one takes the spoon and lifts it up in the air. And as the sugarcane juice drips, when it's just at the right stage, it hardens into a thin thread, like toffee candy, right in the air. And then one knows that now this is at the correct stage to make gur or molasses. So then one takes it down, puts it into a container. But that in itself doesn't make gur. No, it just stays like a soup. It's a secret, which only the expert, you see, sugarcane processors know. So, I'm going to reveal this to you. But this is not for publishing. So, one has to take, you see, a particle of sugar or some crystal from another container. And, of course, there's a way one can manufacture, but it's very difficult. So it's much easier to take one seed of the crystal. And as soon as that one particle of crystal is dropped in that hot, thick coffee soup, immediately the whole thing crystallizes in little crystals. In little crystals. But just like that, you see, we may be practicing our devotional service and we're making some progress. But we are still dependent on the mercy, always, you see, the mercy of the Vaishnavas, mercy of the spiritual master. That mercy, that association, that mercy from outside, that is what gives the real form to our devotional service. Other than that, we can go up to a certain stage. But finally, Krishna's mercy, Guru's mercy, is necessary to actually get to the perfection of the platform. So, now we have gur. But gur, of course, as you know, gur has got a little molasses in it, which is a little bit bitter. So we want to get gur candy. This is much more sweet. So there again, we have to take, and we have to cook down a little further. And we have to stretch that, add a little milk and stretch, and that becomes gur candy. That can be further refined by adding milk and different things. One can get brown sugar. From the brown sugar, one can further refine and get white sugar. And from white sugar, one can further refine and get sugar candy. This sugar candy, that is the highest and pure platform of sugar. So now we've gone through the whole you see, range. From the seed of the sugar cane right to the sugar candy. So this has been described by Bhaktivinoda Thakur as the seed is the Shraddha, or faith, and the sugarcane juice, that is a satsanga, association of devotees. When that is further refined to gur, gur, that's sugar molasses mixed crystal. You know gur here?
Oh, yes. We happen to have 6 tons of them.
6 tons.
Someone gave donations, 6 tons of gourds.
Very tasty. So that is compared to anarthanivritti bhajan kriya. Devotional service with some unwanted characteristics which have to be purified. Mm. Then the next stage is, of course, the sugar, gur candy. Gur candy is like fixed devotional service, nishtha. And the brown sugar, that is like ruchi, taste for devotional service. Then the purified white sugar, that is like ashakti. Ashakti is the attachment to devotional service. And bhava, this is like unrefined sugar candy. There's an unrefined type of sugar candy, and then there's the big chunks of refined sugar candy. So the unrefined sugar candy, that is bhava or ecstatic devotion, where one starts manifesting the 8 astasattvika bhav, 8 symptoms of crying, laughing, etc., etc. Prema, or pure love of God, that is the pure sugar candy. So in this way the comparison has been made. One can see very easily, simply by practicing the sugar candy.
And we make lovely sugar cane too. You know, we make lovely sugar cane as well.
You make?
We make lovely sugar cane.
From
where we
come from.
Chai.
So now you make.
You make a seed of devotion grow. Just in the same process.
Rohini Namdana? Shri Rohini Namdana Prabhu.
Should I ask?
He asked.
One has to be very careful. You see, that when the impurities come up, if one is not careful and he allows, you see, it's bubbling. Water is turning, it's bubbling. So as soon as it comes up, one has to take it and throw. It's like a puri spoon. And the sugar cane. In the same way, when our thoughts come, if we hesitate, some thought comes, and if we think, oh, yes, that's not that, I might be able to enjoy in this material world that way. But no, but I should, if we just hesitate, you see, if we just allow ourselves to think that there's any alternative whatsoever to enjoying, you see, any alternative to being happy, other than Krishna consciousness, when the thought comes up, then you see that that's like the impurity coming up, again it boils and mixes again. Again that will come up again. It'll come up and up and up and up again until we take it and just throw it. Until when it comes up, we just reject. So, of course, at the same time, it also seems when you're cooking the gourd, like an unending amount of foam coming. I mean, it takes a good hour. You see, I'm cooking that, and then it comes, keeps coming, coming. So how many millions of births we've been riding in this material world, how many impurities we have, you may be astonished to find out. But of course, the more one puts his devotional heat on, and the more expert he is in throwing the impurities out whenever they come, you see, the quicker the job will be. And within a very short time, you will have the pure juice.
How should one approach Krishna?
Recommendation of Lord Krishna. One should approach
in humility. And one imagines himself to be more intelligent than the spiritual master, then he won't be able to gain the full mercy. One imagines that the spiritual master is an ordinary man, then he won't be able to appreciate the instructions of the spiritual master. He's rejecting and accepting. Just like with anybody, we may reject something and accept something. They say, with the spiritual master, we cannot act in that way. So the main point is, you know, you have to approach with humility. If someone is worth approaching as guru, then he's worth approaching as with humility. And if someone is not worth approaching with humility, then he's not worth approaching at all. There's no use in accepting a spiritual master's fashion as a fad. One has to approach in a very serious, deadly, it is deadly serious. Our approach to the Guru is a deadly serious matter. Because as Srila Charipad has very nicely described, it is by his mercy that we may become finally extricated from our eons-long sojourn in this material world of birth and death. So we have to approach in deadly seriousness and with all humility. That will put us in the proper frame of mind for hearing his instructions. Another question? Acha, the conversation is coming a little better now. Very good. You saw the Vatsala?
I was wondering, since the election of the communist government in West Bengal, has this affected the construction of Mayapur City at all?
Has this
affected the construction of Mayapur City in the West?
Communists have almost given up on Mayapur.
Yeah.
Of course, they haven't fully given up. But what have we asked? We approached one of the communist ministers to get a big part for a Rathyatra festival 2 years ago. And that time we showed him all the pictures. We showed him London history, Bahavan history picture. We showed him Rathyatra here and different places. And he was saying, oh, fantastic, wonderful, this is great. Oh. And we thought, you know, like when you come into a light member's office and you sit there, the man's going to take cash. So, and then after it was all over, then we asked him, you know, that please, so now if we could get the park for our fair. Then he smiled and said, don't bother. He said, don't waste your time. No, you can't have it. Everyone was shocked. But we're doing such nice work. In Mayapur, we're feeding so many people. There's so many people who are going to our school there. So many people are working. Then he said, whatever you're doing in Mayapur, do it there. But don't do anything in Calcutta. If you try, then I will crush you. So then they said, why are you saying that? He said, you have an ideology. You have a philosophy, and your philosophy and my philosophy is complete opposite. My philosophy is to stop your ideology. So, unfortunately, we have to announce that this minister is paralyzed. The left side of his body became paralyzed. And he had to come to America for treatment.
I'm not supposed to relish these things.
So, the thing is that I'm going to show compassion. Then we approach the government for a part, and because he wasn't present, so he left some message, you can't have that part. But so we took another part, which he didn't leave any message, because he was in the hospital. So as it turned out, that the part we took us through that biggest part of town, to all the main streets right up the Central Avenue. And it was actually a better place than the place we'd asked for. It was Krishna's mercy. So,
how many people attended that?
30 lakhs.
That's three million
people. They said, you please stay on the one side of the road. So that traffic can go by. But after we got halfway along the trade route, there was just no question about side of the road. There was no road. There were simply people. So it was taking so long, right in the middle, the previous year what happened, there was a big crowd also, the people pulled it, and it was so dangerous that it almost smashed into a wall. That by Krishna's mercy, the front wheels bent in a little bit. So we got an air brake power truck to lift the front of it up, and the people pulled the power truck. That was 2 years ago. So this year we had a special air brake, and we had a big steering mechanism, because the trouble there is that when the people pull it, they don't pull, they run! they kind of run, and then the cart, when it lurches forward, they're afraid that they're going to get crushed, I think, and they just run faster! And so it becomes, then you're very frantic. I have several ladies almost got crushed. So it was a very frantic thing. So what happened was we had this air brake. So because we had to use the air brake so much, because there was a car that was pulling and an air brake. So when we got about, it's a 9 kilometer route. So after we got 5 kilometers, that was at the very beginning. That from that time on, we were just solid people. The air tank got empty. So we had to stop right there, and there were so many people. But there was no incident. There was no incident whatsoever. What happened though? One guy hit a devotee, and all of a sudden, from nowhere, this bull came and smashed that guy. This huge bull just went through the crowd and started throwing these people at him. But there was nowhere they could go, because it was just, packed in. The bull was just having a heyday. So finally they drove him out. In the meantime, we got the spare air tank on, and we shortened the rope half, to 20 feet instead of 50 feet. So then they are pulling it. We couldn't see, there were some, curbs and this, that. We couldn't see anything. We just see the people. So what happened, the devotees were doing kirtan. They had seven different parties doing kirtan. There were four outside groups. So the procession alone was about a kilometer and a half in length. So we had to stop three sankirtan parties. They simply stood in front of the people and held them back, so that instead of running, they would just kind of trot. Otherwise, it was just so frantic. The cart was just going so fast. It was a 5-ton cart, but the people just pulled it like that. So finally, we got to the. There was no untoward incident. The whole thing, it was amazing. So in this way, there was a 9-day festival, and a big candle program at the 9th day. And again, we took the duties back. On our back trip, there was about 750,000 people were there. Not as many. So when we're going, though, we can put a light inside the rock, because at that time it was dark, and the whole rock just lit up in the street. It was so, because in Calcutta, of course, here you might think, you know, lit up, but in Calcutta, there's no electricity. Due to constant load shedding. That is the one thing that the communists have been able to do, is they've been able to not generate electricity. So, the whole card was
completed. I was just reading the other day in some communist country, they were saying that the communists had achieved success. They made everyone equal. In this country, everyone was equally miserable.
So it was just lit up very beautifully. And then we took the deity. We just kept going. It was just so many. It was just like ocean of people. I couldn't see. One car tried to get through and got about a quarter of a kilometer through and just got kind of just like, it was like, you know, when you see someone going through a boat through the water or something, the people just edging through and just, we never made it. It was really inspiring. Everyone was chanting. We brought about 2 tons of white sugar candy, which were throwing out knuckle dummy. And the people just were screaming we had to be very careful because whenever the cart moved, we couldn't throw because the people would run underneath the cart, zap, and there's these big 9-foot wheels, you know, turning. One lady fell down under the cart and the whole cart rolled right over. But somehow she was in the middle and the wheels missed her. And she got up on the other side and she was, of course, a little bit upset. The police said it was the biggest procession they ever saw. As soon as they saw the crowd, they got in the police van and just sat down and didn't do anything. They were helpless. But the people themselves, they cooperated. So after that, it was a very successful thing. In Mayapur, we had that incident which 2 years ago, and after that we had a procession where the 25,000 people marched, and after that they just complete hands-off policy. And after that, you see what happened, they thought they would just like create some havoc, but when it got all over international newspapers and the central government the consulate from America and France, they came out to my school and they told me that the chief minister, who's the head of the Communist Party there, he came and said, I wish it had never happened. Because he got a lot of headaches, because he got letters from Washington and that, because the different nationalities that were involved, each of the countries sent messages why our countrymen our citizens are being harassed. There was a French, there was a British, there was, you know, American, so. So actually, the main trouble in Mayapur, we got a bigger obstacle where there's this crazy lady who was the district magistrate. And she was a complete demon. When she came there, she announced herself that she was the incarnation of Durga. and she tried to show that she was the expert administrator. But she created such a havoc in the district that she's been transferred as the head clerk of the Life Insurance Corporation of India. And so she's no longer there. And the president district magistrate who's there, who has really much more to do with Mayapur, he came with his wife and had a darshan twice at Mayapur, said he loved Mayapur very much. He found it very clean and very well managed. And I mean, just from his, you know, he has no comparison. But things are progressing there. We're getting, right now, of course, we're not doing the big temple. We're doing the Samadhi Mandir for Siddha Prabhupada. And the big temple, of course, we're doing some preliminary design. And of course, other people may also be doing design. So whatever the design the DBC decides on ultimately will be built. So right now, as far as actual construction, we're working in Prabhupada's Samadhi Mandir. And that's a very big task. I just happened to show the head of the Chaitanya Mat came over to our architectural office. We have a team of about 12 architects working, you know, very fucka air-conditioned office with drawing tables and special lighting. You go in, it's very professional. And this professional is anything I've seen. So, when he went there and saw the design, he just looked at it. And he just looked at it. And he looked at it. And he said, I never saw a temple like that before. Then he said that, said, how big is it going to be? Then we told him, it's going to be about 200 feet. And he said, wow. Said, well, he was just speechless, and he said that so many people will come to see. So we got everything ready just to we could have started a token at the Janmashtami, but we're purchasing a few pieces of land right around the area. And because there's a very high river level right now, so we're just going to start as soon as the danger of flood is over, because otherwise we might incur a big loss, which is about middle of October. At that time, we're going to start driving the pile. Prabhupada always dreamed of the day when the pile would shake all the other temples.
That's samadhi, actually. Remember that originally...
Oh, the very good news, let me tell you about Vrindavan Samadhi. The Vrindavan Samadhi, the permission. See, what happened was that there was some engineer who was just holding everything up because he wanted a bride, but then someone squealed on him, and then he got real frightened. So then he just took a hands-off policy. So what happened is the district magistrate, he has to get permission, and above him there's a commissioner. He has to get permission. And for this, they're running around for about 3 months now until they get the permission, because it's a municipal area that they need permission. They couldn't go forward. So it just so happened that this commissioner came out to see the Vrindavan temple. And he went there and he had darshan. They gave him a full prasadam. He was a Sikh gentleman. And he was fully satisfied. And so then they approached him and told him this is the problem. And he said immediately. And so already the district magistrate has signed. And by now I think that the commissioner would also read the signs. He probably have already signed by now. So immediately the Vrindavan temple can also begin. Gunanava and others, they're working very hard for that.
Yes, they sent me telegram. You know, he was in such ecstasy. Must have been sending telegrams.
Oh, he gave them it. Yeah. No, okay, it was really an ordeal.
No, it was one of our favorite sons here. No?
Yeah. None of the soul.
Yeah, she's just like this son. Any other questions? Why we're struggling?
Why is it that, you know, if they move as far as spread?
Of course, Srila Charyapada was talking on this point this morning. That, of course, in the material universe, there is always struggle between the devotees and the non-devotees. This struggle must be there. Even in the very dawning years of the universe, there was struggle between the devotees and the non-devotees. As you know, there was some churning of the ocean. Mandar Mountain is there, and there is some training. So, finally, Lord Vishnu had to incarnate in order to assist the devotees in defeating the demons. So, this is the Lord's pastime. The devotees are trying to serve Krishna. And they're getting opposition from the non-devotees. So because of that opposition, they're having to take shelter more and more of Krishna. They're having to call out to him. My dear Lord, I'm dying to render some service to you. But in spite of all my efforts, opposition is coming from the non-devotee class of men. And so many difficulties are there. Please assist us so that we can serve you more and more nicely. So in that way, the devotees are taking more and more shelter of Krishna. And Krishna on his side, he's saying, oh, my devotees are in distress. They're trying to push forward this movement on my behalf, and yet still they're getting opposition from the non-devotees. I will have to personally come to their assistance. So in that way, simply sweetens me. Transcendental flavors. I'm saying that there's some opposition from the non-devotee class. And there was no opposition. Then we more or less become, how did you say it, not extinct, what is the word? Obsolete. We become useless. And there was no opposition. And then we would have to use our intelligence how to spread Krishna consciousness. What Krishna wants is to pray to him, give us intelligence how to spread Krishna consciousness. He wants us to take shelter of him. So these oppositions are good, actually. Prabhupada never minded opposition. He only minded if we lost heart in the face of opposition. Opposition will always be there. But this gives the opportunity for the devotees to perform so many heroic deeds. Just like Srila Prabhupada in the Bombay property. Certainly Krishna could have immediately given the property, is it not? Do you think that Krishna could not have given the Bombay property? But he said there was so much opposition. So much opposition. So many troubles arose. And Srila Prabhupada very valiantly continued with the fight because he had promised Sri Sri Radharasa Bihari that he was going to build him a palace. So he very heroically and valiantly went on with the struggle, and finally the victory came. So Prabhupada, as a result, became glorified in Krishna's eyes and in everyone's eyes. Because in the face of all opposition, he pushed forward heroically and was ultimately victorious by Lord the Great. So if there had been no struggle, then he couldn't be glorifying Srila Prabhupada at this moment. He could be glorifying for some other thing. There's so many worthy of glorification on so many points, unlimited points. But still this point. So there will be opposition, there will be struggle. Devotees will have to take shelter of the Lord, they'll have to pray to the Lord for assistance. So they get good intelligence how to spread Krishna consciousness. But ultimately we will be successful, and as a result, a new chapter will be written in Chaitanya Charitamrita Srimad Bhagavatam. How the devotees of this ISKCON movement under the direction of His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada have transformed the whole face of the earth with Krishna Bhakti. And that chapter will be written. But a story without a little adventure is never eligible. This is like, who would be Mahabharata if the story meant something like this? Then Pandu had five sons. They grew up very nicely, and they became the rulers of the kingdom. Everyone lived in peace and prosperity, and then they passed away, and who knows, it would be interesting. Is it? But because there were so many difficulties, sometimes they were being exiled, sometimes there was war, this and that, and one. And finally, Mr. Maharaj was crowned the king, and the whole countryside rejoiced, and the universe, all the demigods came and showered flowers. People have been meeting it ever since.